He's back. Yes, Tim Pawlenty. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty wants to take the former out of his title. Hi, it's Mike McEntee. It's kind of the talk of this afternoon. Just about an hour ago, Tim Pawlenty issued a video saying that he's running for governor. Why, might you ask? Why would he want that job again? Well, here's his answer.
Why am I running? I've lived my whole life here. As the proud son of a truck driver and a mom who died when I was 16, I worked my way through college, and Mary and I raised our kids here. I want to finally put those in the middle first. It's a better way forward.
Yeah, he wants to put those in the middle first. You buying that? What do you think about Tim Pawlenty running? We're opening the phones here today, 952-946-6205. Do you buy that Tim Pawlenty is running for the common guy, the middle? This is the guy who's been working for the bankers for the last several years. A guy who ran for president and deep sixed Minnesota while he was doing it. We can't ask Pawlenty any more about his run today because the announcement he made was a YouTube video, but we can talk about some of the claims that he made in the video. First up, Pawlenty claims he is going to be good for education.
When I was governor, we were number one in ACT scores and in the top three states for teaching math and science. But we've slipped.
Yeah, we slipped. We had some problems. And a lot of that was, remember, numbers on education don't show up the minute that you're governor. They show up years later. And that's one of the reasons that scores fall. But let's look at the other numbers. Alliance for Better Minnesota has some of the numbers. Governor Tim Pawlenty cut $185 million from K through 12 education, which resulted in thousands of teacher layoffs. That'll improve scores, I'm sure. He cut $386 million from higher education while college tuition costs became increasingly unaffordable for students. And also recall that under Tim Pawlenty, the state borrowed millions of dollars from local school districts that wasn't paid back until Governor Mark Dayton raised taxes on the wealthy to pay it back. Some other things, we're just kind of picking through some of the things in the announcement here. It was like about a 2.5 minute video. Had, you know, Tim Pawlenty, he's looking older than you remember him, but he's standing in a living room. All that nice music is playing in the background, and he's reading this, obviously, off of a, you know, maybe it's off a prompter, maybe he's memorized it, but he's got this little speech. And, you know, he gets to several points. He talks about health care, and then he talks. He talks about immigration. In the era of Trump, you have to throw a bone to the party, the Republican Party, that considers immigration the root of all evil.
Let's stop hiding behind political correctness and make sure people getting government benefits are here legally. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah, no-brainer. Okay, no welfare for undocumented workers. That's a Trump talking point, and you may or may not agree with it, but there's already a federal law that prohibits that. The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, which flows off the tongue, said immigrants legally or, I guess, would be illegally in the U.S. who entered the United States on or after August 22nd, 1996, when the law was enacted, would not be eligible for federal means-tested public benefits for 5 years, starting on the date of their entry into the United States with a status that met definition of qualified alien. No, you cannot get government benefits, federal government benefits, you know, like welfare, if you are an undocumented worker. So maybe he meant Social Security. No, undocumented immigrants are not eligible to receive Social Security benefits, even though many contribute to the system. Many undocumented workers are in the formal sector and contribute to Social Security. The trust fund estimates suggest that up to $12 billion per year are contributed by undocumented immigrants and their employers. So it's not any of these federal programs. So what is it that the state does pay for undocumented immigrants? We're trying to figure out what Tim Pawlenty's talking about. Undocumented immigrants are legally required to have access to K through 12 public school. Maybe that's it. Nationally, the share of children who are undocumented immigrants and attend kindergarten through 12th grade at public and private schools is relatively small. It makes up 1.3% of the total enrollment. That's in 2014 nationally. Okay, well, that's not a big thing. So, again, we're trying to figure out what Tim Pawlenty meant about that. Maybe, well, it just leaves state-funded safety net programs. And really, you want to be mean and cut off humanitarian support for people who are too poor to survive in Minnesota? Excuse me, in America and in Minnesota? This is, I don't know, that's just kind of mean. And then there's the whole issue of why Governor Pawlenty decided not to run for a third term. What was it? Oh, yeah, he was running for president. Yeah, that didn't go too well, did it? Here's another former governor, Arne Carlson, on that topic.
Big bone that I would pick with Governor Pawlenty is that he used the governorship of the state of Minnesota as a stepping stone to national office and all too often sacrificed the needs of Minnesota in order to achieve his personal objective. And the result was, I think it's fair to say we went from deficit to deficit to deficit. We borrowed from the future to prevent tax increases. And the state, frankly, was in a whale of a mess when Governor Dayton took over.
Yeah, it was. And 8 years later, we're in a lot better shape. That has to do with Governor Dayton reversing a lot of things Tim Pawlenty did, not following what Governor Scott Walker is doing in Wisconsin. And you see how well they're doing these days. So what do you think? 952-946-6205. We're going to get into reaction here from other candidates, Republicans and Democrats. But first, I'd like to hear from you. 952-946-6205. Joanne from Roseville wanted to jump in. Hi, Joanne. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just fine. What do you think about Tim Pawlenty running for governor again?
I went through the Pawlenty years. And my property taxes, I live in Roseville, my property taxes went up so high, we were just absolutely shocked. The stuff he did, he put everything on a credit card. That's why I will never vote for a GOP again. What he's running for, he's lying, just like Trump, just like all the other GOP. They don't believe in that. They don't believe in the middle class. Why do you think they give the 1% or the wealthiest or even the corporations all these subsidies, this welfare? They don't believe in us. They don't believe in the common person. I would never vote a GOP, especially Pawlenty. Never trusted him. He did not do us a favor for Minnesota. Poor Governor Dayton had such a mess, more like Arne Carlson was saying, had such a mess when he came into office. But he turned our state around. We were like a test tube. Look at Wisconsin, what Walker's doing. He's ruined that state. And hopefully this, with the wave of blue that's coming in November, we can fix that. But that's my point. I don't care for Pawlenty, and thank you so much.
I kind of gathered that you didn't like Tim Pawlenty. Yes, property taxes did take a big hit during the Pawlenty years. I mean, they've been going up since, but it's not been the same type of thing. And as far as helping the middle class, that wasn't exactly on Pawlenty's list either. He gave tax breaks to the rich, and Governor Dayton reversed that as well, and actually worked more on the 1% and made a big difference there. And that is what has kept us on a fiscally stable budget here in Minnesota. 952-946-6205. We're talking about Tim Pawlenty, and he's running for governor again. We'll get to reaction here from the candidates, but Mike from Columbia Heights wants to talk about Tim Pawlenty as well. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
Wasn't he the one that dispersed the geriatric sex offenders throughout the nursing home system in Minnesota, and then one of them molested an elderly, incapacitated woman, and then it all came out, and it was Pawlenty's idea to do it? Wasn't he the one?
You know, I don't recall exactly. I know they had problems with that. I'm not sure if that was something that he put forward or not.
Well, you should look into it, because he did. You know what else he did? He doubled the fees on licenses, professional licenses, for example, the steam fitter's license. Steam fitter's license, he doubled it $10 to $20, and he doubled a lot of the other license fees in order to cover up for his malfeasance in finance. He also took the tobacco settlement and put the tobacco settlement in the general fund in order to cover up his financial malfeasance.
I know that
He's
got transferred.
A real peach.
I wasn't sure if that was during the Pawlenty years or if the legislature did it under another way, but that debt did happen. I'm not sure if Pawlenty was entirely responsible for that, but I do know that he was known as Governor Pawlenty by some people before for some of the things he was doing, because he didn't want to say I was raising taxes, so he'd put these fees on, which are worse because you can't deduct fees on your federal taxes. So we ended up paying more here in Minnesota because the governor wanted to keep away from the tax word, the T word, but we still ended up paying and actually paying more. Mike, thank you so much for the comments. Did you want to add anything else there? Okay. 952-946-6205. We're talking about Governor Tim Pawlenty, former Governor Tim Pawlenty, wanting to be Governor Tim Pawlenty again. Let's go to the Republican side here first. Jeff Johnson, the guy who is, the likely guy who is going to get the Republican endorsement until today's announcement. Who knows what will happen now? Jeff Johnson ran against Governor Mark Dayton in the last cycle and lost badly. Jeff Johnson issues a statement saying, "I welcome Tim to the race and look forward to showing Minnesota Republicans why I'm a stronger candidate in November." He says, "Tim Pawlenty has never gotten over 46% of the vote in a statewide election." True. He's won by pluralities in the past. And that was even after being a governor for 4 years. He says, again, this is going to Jeff Johnson's statement. He said before he made $10 million as a Washington, D.C. lobbyist and before he publicly trashed Donald Trump a month before Election Day, he's the last person Republicans would want at the top of a ticket in 2018. Well, considering how well Donald Trump polls in Minnesota, maybe Tim Pawlenty's onto something there. But Jeff Johnson continues, 2018 is radically different from 2002 or 2006. Working class Minnesotans are sick and tired of politics as usual and being ignored by their elected leaders. Tim began this campaign by convening a private meeting of 100 of the wealthiest donors in Minnesota to solicit their approval and money. It's not a promising sign that he understands the Minnesota of today. Is Jeff Johnson, one of the candidates running for governor, and actually Tim Pawlenty held most of his fundraisers, or a lot of his fundraisers, in Florida. And that's where we first really got an indication that he was running, because he was holding those down there. We should also note that former U.S. Senator Norm Coleman's super PAC, Minnesota Action Network, says it's in favor of Tim Pawlenty's run. I guess that comes of really of no surprise there. Let's get to the candidates here on the DFL side. We've been soliciting, what the responses are. We have responses from two of the three here. Rebecca Otto, here's her statement on Governor Tim Pawlenty running. She says when Pawlenty was governor, he made bad budget decisions that harmed our health care coverage, cut the funding and quality of our public schools, increased college tuition, and let our bridges and roads crumble. This is again Rebecca Otto. She says, Minnesotans have told me we need to elect a governor who will prioritize affordable and accessible health care for all, invest in a stronger education system, and proactively address our crumbling infrastructure. Pawlenty is simply the wrong choice for Minnesota right now. Again, that is Rebecca Otto. Tim Walz is also running on the DFL side. We don't have a statement from him, but we do from Erin Murphy, the third candidate on the DFL side. She says, when Tim Pawlenty cut health care for homeless vets and people experiencing extreme poverty, I fought back with a coalition of Minnesotans, protected the health care safety net for our state's most vulnerable. And when he decided to run for president, Pawlenty left Minnesotans with a $6.2 billion budget deficit and our schools starved for funding. As majority leader, I was proud to turn that deficit into a surplus and pay back the money owed to schools. Yes, that happened under Erin Murphy. That also happened under Governor Mark Dayton. She says, as the only DFL candidate for governor that's beat Tim at his own political gain and cleaned up the mess that he left at Minnesotans, I would like to welcome him to the race. Okay. I'm confident my grassroots campaign that puts Minnesotans at the center of our politics in order to build a healthier, more just state will provide a clear contrast to his Wall Street credentials and dismal record. Okay. And not missing any words there. We welcome him to the race. We're going to beat him, says Erin Murphy. Ken Martin, DFL chair, not surprising, kind of just came out with a blistering statement saying, Minnesota needs a governor who will fight for everyday families. That's not Tim Pawlenty. As governor, he deprived thousands of Minnesota of affordable health care. He's jeopardized our children's education. He devastated our budget. He left roads and bridges across the state to crumble. Tim Pawlenty failed our state. We need an honest leader who will fight to build a better Minnesota, not a Wall Street lobbyist who cares more about the wealthy than everyday families. Again, this is all reaction pouring in here since Tim Pawlenty announced about an hour and 20 minutes ago via a YouTube video that he is running for governor in Minnesota here again. A note here, we are going to have on the show today Edwin Rios from Mother Jones to talk about education and what's happening in Oklahoma, where the teachers have walked out. Unfortunately, the teachers were rallying at the Capitol here as we got the show going this afternoon, and Edwin is down there. So things are very, very busy, but I just wanted to mention some of the issues down there, that the protests are continuing for a fourth straight day. Teachers there are amongst the lowest paid in the country. And that's despite a governor signing a bill that raised teacher salaries. The walkout is continuing. They would like to see more money spent on education as well as their salaries. This is happening because Republicans have been controlling states like Oklahoma, like Arizona, where there are walkouts under, you know, under discussion, and Kentucky, where that's happened during spring break, and in West Virginia, where they had a successful strike. These are all red states. Are there similar problems brewing in blue states here like Minnesota? Well, coming up here next on the program, we're going to speak with Education Minnesota, the teachers union here in Minnesota, and their president on what's happening on the frontier in Minnesota with education and labor. That's all next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Victor's 1959 Cafe in South Minneapolis is a locally owned and operated restaurant offering traditional Cuban food. Open for breakfast and lunch daily with dinner Tuesday through Saturday. For night shift workers, Victor's even has both a morning and evening happy hour, and Victor's now accepts dinner reservations too. Stop in and try some delicious, authentic Cuban cuisine like ropa vieja and seafood paella. Make your reservation and learn more at victors1959cafe.com. Victor's 1959 Cafe, revolutionary Cuban cooking.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is all digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
As Trump assembles a war cabinet, including John Bolton as National Security Advisor and Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State, as the U.S. continues to wage war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, and as Trump threatens war with North Korea, it is time to act. Stop the endless U.S. wars. Say no to new wars with Iran or North Korea. Join an anti-war protest on Sunday, April 15th, that is part of National Spring Actions Against Endless War. Gather at Hennepin and Lagoon at 1:30. March at 2 p.m. with a return to the starting location. As the doomsday clock is set for 2 minutes to midnight and the military budget grows, demand money for housing, education, and the environment. Join the anti-war protest on April 15th at Hennepin and Lagoon in Minneapolis. Gather at 1:30, march at 2. Initiated by Minnesota Peace Action Coalition. For more information, call 612-827-5364. That's 612-827-5364.
Take it to the limit one more time. Take it to
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. We've been talking about teachers in several states that have walked out of classrooms or are planning to do so because their state's low pay and lack of support for education. As we watch Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona, you have to ask, is something like that brewing for Minnesota? Joining us now to talk about that is Denise Specht. She is the president for Education Minnesota. Denise, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you on here. Now, Education Minnesota is a union. Minnesota teachers have a union that allows them to strike when, you know, you get to that point. Does that make our state less susceptible to walkouts like we've seen in Oklahoma and Kentucky?
Well, you know, there are some differences, that's for sure. I mean, and one is something that you just mentioned, bargaining. We are a collective bargaining state. And so what happens here that's a little bit different in others is that you will have contracts negotiated in every single school district with every single bargaining unit. So, you know, right now we've got most of the teacher locals who are starting to wrap up the contracts that expired last year, but we've got support staff going to the table now as well. And they are talking about, you know, obviously pay and benefits and, you know, policies and workplace issues that are going to help students and themselves as workers.
Pay, benefits, also, you know, workplace conditions. These are the things that have led teachers in Oklahoma and Arizona to walk out or consider walking out. You tweeted here just recently that Minnesota teachers are walking. It may not be an organized picket line. You said they're walking or marching out the door, never to return. Tell me what you meant by that.
That's right. I mean, I think that the teachers in Minnesota have been maybe a little bit more quietly because it hasn't been an organized picket line or an organized rally per se, but they are telling us something because we have a teacher shortage here in Minnesota. It's a crisis. We have people leaving the profession way too early, and it's just not walking out to take a stand and come back. They're walking out and they're never returning to the profession. And I think that that's quite a crisis here. So it's significant. And we've been seeing this for a long time.
How does that teacher shortage look in Minnesota? Is it all schools, all areas, or is it concentrated in certain districts, certain professions, certain, you know, types of teachers? Where are we seeing the shortages?
Well, I think we're seeing the shortage everywhere. You know, a number of years ago, it was, you know, pretty much identified to, you know, special education courses or math positions or science positions, particularly in greater Minnesota. But we're finding that, you know, these shortages are even hitting elementary schools now. I think the evidence is, you know, when you look at licenses that are being issued to teachers who are working in positions in which they're not trained or qualified. They're not really licensed to be doing the work that they're doing because school districts have found themselves to be in an emergency. We're seeing more and more of that.
When we have those emergencies you just mentioned, we end up with teachers who maybe aren't, you know, this isn't their strength on the issue they're teaching, but do we end up with larger classroom sizes? How else does this impact the local school districts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can't find staff, you have to make up for that somehow. You're either putting somebody in the schools that isn't qualified, or you're raising class sizes, or you're cutting programs. I mean, all of these things hurt kids. But if you don't mind, I would like to get back to, you know, why Minnesota educators are walking out, because
sure,
they are leaving the profession. And we're seeing a couple of reasons. One, and it's pretty similar to what we're seeing in Oklahoma and Arizona, and it's pocketbook issues. It's just personal economic issues. Child care is going up. Education debt is, you know, a crisis right now. Health care costs are going up. And paychecks just are not keeping up with all of those rising costs. So there's that. But because of the disinvestment in the Pawlenty years and over time, we're seeing that school districts have not been able to keep up with the rising costs of doing business. So you have academically programs are being cut. You know, over time we see nurses being cut, counselors being cut, social workers being cut, you know, key employees that are there to help meet the needs of our students. Academically, we've seen arts being cut, languages being cut, you know, opportunities for students. But, you know, the lack of respect and lack of autonomy are also driving, you know, teachers out of the profession. So when you think about those, I guess, two economic buckets, one is the pocketbook issues that are hitting educators, you know, in their own household budgets, but also the economics of a school district, what's being cut, what isn't being provided for students. Those are all issues that are adding a lot of stress to the workplace, and people are leaving.
Let's talk about one of those issues you just mentioned, respect, because I don't think that gets brought up enough. There has been a narrative, I think mostly from the right, against teachers, and the only way, only reason I've been able to figure out why there is such a thing is that the right is concerned because the teachers have a union that doesn't align with what they think, you know, what how they vote, how the right likes to vote. I mean, is that your experience? Is that what's going on here? Is that why we are having, you know, the denigration of teachers, where we have other public service such as the military and the police being held up, but teachers are always always being the ones that are being criticized?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it comes in a lot of shapes and forms. One is what you just said. I mean, that teachers are supposed to solve every single problem in the world. That's very difficult. We know how to teach, and I think we do it well. But when we also have to make sure that students are fed and they have a roof over their heads and their parents have jobs, I think that that's a really, really tough job when it gets down to it. Those are big hurdles that we have to jump. But the other is just the professional respect. I mean, think about the environment that we're seeing right now, even at the Capitol. We have policymakers telling educators what to do every single day. You know, whether it's you can't teach critical thinking or now you've got to think about this standard. Let's face it, teachers are sick and tired of being told what to do all the time. They are professionals. They've got degrees, and they're actually really good at what they do. And the fact that we have legislated pretty much every single part of our day, it's discouraging.
Let's talk about some of the legislative solutions that are floating out there. One of them has been, and I've watched committee hearings on this, is to change change up or make it easier for people to become teachers, changing the requirements on what's called teacher licensure and the tiers, moving from one tier to another. And it gets kind of complicated. I don't even understand it. But from what I basically understand is that there's a move to make things easier so somebody who is coming from another state can come in here and teach. And that's being viewed as, oh, that's a way to solve our problem. Tell me, what's your reaction to those attempts?
You know, from Education Minnesota's point of view, we are not opposed to tiers per se. It's what's in those tiers, and it's how people are being licensed. That's our objection. I mean, for the first time ever, we are going to have people licensed to teach in Minnesota without any training, teaching training, without any experience. And I think that that's wrong. But it gets to, I think, the short-term Band-Aid solution that you've been describing is there are people out there that believe that our answer to fixing the teaching shortage is to just make it easier to teach. You know, let's create these fast, easy pathways for people who aren't trained to get into the classroom. Look, teaching is hard, and it should be hard because these are really important jobs. We should not be looking for fast-tracking our way into the profession. But that's the short-term solution that was in front of us last year, and we opposed many of the tiers, I should say, because we just believe that we should be raising standards, not lowering them, because the expectations are just that high. But what we didn't see happening is people really tackling what I believe are the long-term problems for why we have a teacher shortage. We should be lowering class sizes. We should be hiring more support staff who are going to help meet the unmet needs of our students. That means more counselors and social workers and school psychologists and people who can really help students with the challenges that they're facing day in and day out. We should also be making sure that we are adding back programs that have been cut so that all of our students have a very rich, well-rounded education when they leave. We should be raising pay. We should be making sure that we are eliminating a lot of barriers to getting into the profession. You know, college affordability and education debt. These are all the things that are driving people out of the profession. But those are really tough things to take on. Those are bold, bold solutions. And that's what we should be talking about. Because here is what I predict. This new tiered licensure system that is going to put untrained educators into our schools is a short-term fix. Those educators are going to leave as well because of all of the things that I just got done talking about. Until we address the real underlying issues of why people are leaving the profession, we're going to have this revolving door in and out of our schools, and that hurts kids.
A lot of the issues we're talking about here have to do with money, but it gets complicated beyond that. I want to bring up one issue that's a problem in other states, because I've got an inkling of what's going on here in Minnesota, but not a really good idea, and that's pensions. In other states like Kentucky, they're trying to get rid of traditional pensions, eliminating them for new teachers. I'm reading that one by one, they're being phased out. How much of an impact does that have, and what's the situation here in Minnesota?
Kentucky is, I think, a little bit different because I believe that their pension system is set up a little bit differently. I don't quote me on this one, but I don't know if they, contribute to Social Security. So the public pension system that they've got set up is really important to them. I think it does become a recruitment and retention issue. I believe that when there is uncertainty in the profession, people are probably less willing to stay. And so when you think about educators in Kentucky and some of the other states where their pension or their economic security beyond retirement, when they enter the profession and see a promise and then, wonder if that promise is going to, continue, or are they going to, can I rely on this? It's unsettling, it's questionable, and I think it does drive people out of the profession. Here in Minnesota, we're having a pension conversation right now at the legislature, and I believe we are really, really close to making sure that some adjustments are made to stabilize the fund.
Because I think last time around, I think because it was bundled in with something else, didn't Governor Dayton end up vetoing it or pushing it aside? So it's an open question right now on how it gets solved.
Right. And so right now, the pension bill passed the Senate. So it's cleared that hurdle. Now we're just looking to the House to take it up and send it to the governor's desk. I know that the governor supports the bill that passed the Senate. And I sure hope that the House follows the Senate's follows them right away, because they had a unanimous vote. I believe it passed with flying colors. And we're really hoping it gets through the House so we can get this done.
All right. We've been speaking with Denise Speck. She is the president of Education Minnesota. Denise, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Well, coming up next here on the Mike McEntee Show, Trumping Up the Census. Why the scientists who use the data from the census are very concerned about what the Trump administration is doing to the 2020 census. And it's more than just scaring immigrants away from responding. That's all next on AM 950.
Kevin Ross here, inviting you to our brand new store called Ambibulous. What does Ambibulous mean? It means one who enjoys alcoholic beverages of all sorts. Ambibulous is a Minnesota maker's market. Unlike traditional liquor stores, we feature only craft beer, wine, and spirits made here in Minnesota. We are ready to guide your selections, where you can build your own 4 or 6 packs. Find us at 949 Hennepin Avenue East in Northeast Minneapolis, or online at ambibulousmn.com.
It's time for spring cleaning. Wait, you weren't planning on getting your carpets cleaned this spring? Getting your carpets cleaned is not just about how your home looks. It's about your family's health, with all the bacteria and allergens building up. That's why Zero Res uses their patented empowered water so you get a healthy and clean home without soapy, crunchy, dirt-attracting residue. This month, get 3 rooms Zero Resified, starting at $139. Plus, this month, save $50 when you get your air ducts Zero Res clean. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMN.com. Zero Res, spelled backward or forward, it spells the same.
This is Bill McLeslie, owner of IP House in Minneapolis. Does the thought of upgrading the computers at your office keep you up at night? Change can be overwhelming, especially when it comes to technology. I started IP House with the mission of making technology simple. We provide tech support for businesses just like yours, managing the technical hurdles so you can sleep at night. If your technology has you worried, call us, IP House, 612-337-6337. 612-337-6337.
Did you know that tooth decay is the most common disease in America, and that over half the American population has some form of periodontal disease? Simply brushing and flossing don't seem to be enough. The abundant bacteria in your mouth thrive off sugar to produce acid and plaque. But what if you could actually prevent bacteria from converting sugar into the harmful byproducts responsible for tooth decay and periodontal disease? Daily Dental Care is a life sciences company that leverages our microbiology expertise to create oral care products that promote strong teeth, healthy gums, and fresh breath. Our lozenges safely and effectively neutralize harmful bacteria and their disease-causing byproducts like acid and plaque, without harming health-promoting bacteria that guard your mouth against the destruction that sugar causes. Supplement your daily dental hygiene routine with our convenient dental lozenges. Go to dailydentalcareswithans.com or Amazon to purchase and use promo code DDC95001 at checkout for a 25% discount on your first purchase.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Daily Dental Care lozenges are not intended to replace daily dental hygiene practices.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. The census happens every 10 years. It's written into the Constitution. It's there to tell us how many people are living in various cities, states, and other jurisdictions in the United States. Beyond directing how many representatives each state gets in Congress, it also provides the government and anybody else who wants to dig into the statistics a treasure trove of data. Gregory Smith-Simon is a professor of sociology who likes to study that data, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
A lot of people are worried about the accuracy of the 2020 census. Are you worried about it?
I'm concerned. I think that the present administration has done more than any of the ones that I've ever seen to put the accuracy of the census in jeopardy. I know that there are a lot of people working to make sure that it goes off smoothly, but I think we all have to keep an eye on it because it's something that affects everybody's lives in pretty direct ways.
I mean, what's threatening the 2020 census? We've heard about budget cuts. We've heard about President Trump's wanting to ask certain questions, and that we've had problems with hiring. What are the? I mean, I've mentioned a few things. Yeah. Are there other things?
Some of them are typical, and some of them are particular to the census. So, Trump had proposed Thomas Brunell being deputy director of the census. It was a job that didn't need congressional approval, so he could slip him in there. And Brunell was sort of notorious for being an expert witness in Republican gerrymandering cases. He wrote a book saying that elections that were not competitive were good for democracy, that it was better to have a lopsided election than one with two politicians who were actually in contention. And so that was an odd choice. The administration seems to have pulled off of that one. The underfunding had real serious effects because there were supposed to be three dry runs of the census, sort of start to finish, and they've had to cancel two. What's interesting is that they're going to go ahead with the one in Providence, Rhode Island, but the sample censuses in rural areas where Republicans are often strongest in West Virginia and Washington State had to be canceled. So we won't know how well this census is going to work until we're doing the real thing. That funding has been restored somewhat, which is reassuring, but it's too late for certain things. It's too late for those tests, and it's too late to do things like roll out mobile technology that was going to allow the census enumerators, the census employees, to have smart devices that could do the tallying instead of having to use pen and paper forms. The one that's really kind of most alarming is a push by Trump's Attorney General Jeffrey Sessions to put a question on the census about whether or not people are citizens. And that might sound like a kind of obvious question for something that's supposed to count how many people are in America, but in fact, it's a risky one for a lot of reasons.
But why are those reasons? Because the census is supposed to be about counting the number of people in the United States, not the number of citizens, correct? And so when you start asking about citizens, how might that skew things?
That's right. The census has has deep roots. It's right there in the Constitution, because if you think about it, we have representatives representing a certain number of people. You got to count those people. In the sense that this Constitution is quite clear that you're supposed to base those representative districts on the number of people who are there, not the number of citizens. And it's always been a challenge in the census to get an accurate count. Not everybody replies. And the census is not allowed to just estimate. They can only count people who they really find in person. So those missing people aren't random. There are groups that get undercounted and overcounted. And among the folks who get undercounted are immigrants, often who are nervous about not getting counted. Already with the anti-immigrant rhetoric of the Trump administration and some of the trial runs they've done, immigrant people from immigrant communities have told census enumerators that they're lying on their census. Spanish-speaking respondents say, you know, we're worried about getting deported. We're not going to tell you who all lives in our house. There was an Arabic speaker who said, look, I've heard all the anti-Arab rhetoric. I don't want him knowing where everybody is. So already there was a sense that Trump's hostility to immigrants was going to make people back off. This citizenship question effectively is designed to do exactly that. By asking people about their citizenship, you're flagging to them that if they're not citizens, whether they're here legally or not, they should think twice about giving the government information because it might make them vulnerable. The census doesn't want people to think that, but it's already clear from the work they've done that people are worried and that this question adds to it. The other thing that's interesting is that Republicans have wanted information on counting the number of citizens for a long time, in part because they want to change the way our American democracy works, so that rather than counting the number of people and making sure all the people are represented, they only want to count, say, citizens or eligible voters, because those smaller, more select numbers skew Republican. So if you only counted eligible voters, you'd only count citizens, not non-citizens, not legal residents. You might not count children, who tend to skew Democratic. You might not count people who have been disenfranchised through felony disenfranchisement laws. There are a whole bunch of ways that you could shrink the number of people who count and favor Republicans, not unlike the original census that told census enumerators to count black slaves as three-fifths of a person because they didn't fully count either. And it's a disturbing echo of that nasty period in American history.
So that's who gets undercounted or might get ignored. Who gets overcounted? I saw your information on this, and I just didn't realize that we get some people in the census who get counted twice.
Yeah, you know, the Census Bureau likes to say that they do a pretty good job because they have the count is very close to what they see as the actual number, because they're overcounts and they're undercounts and they even out. Well, they don't really. The Census in 2010 didn't count 1.6 million people who were black and Latino who actually existed but didn't get counted. That got canceled out in the Census's math because while they didn't count 1.6 million black and Latino Americans, they counted 1.8 million white people who didn't exist. And the way you count people who don't exist is that you send a census form to every home in the United States, and people who own second homes can get counted twice. The form shows up at the White House, and the president fills it out, and the form shows up at Mar-a-Lago, and the president fills it out, and the form shows up on Fifth Avenue, and the president fills it out. And in theory, you could have Donald Trump getting counted three times at three different houses, while somebody down the street doesn't get counted at all because they're afraid that their citizenship status is going to get them into hot water.
Now, one strange thing in the census that, and again, since you study this, I don't know this, but I was looking at your notes on this, and that we ask people about their race. And over the years, that has changed a lot. And you write that's based upon who we've invaded or colonized?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I don't think that the census would tell you that once we put a target on somebody's back, we put them on the census. But the history of the census goes along with that when you look at the categories, the main racial categories are today are black, white, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic, which sort of gets counted in a particular, peculiar way in the census. But when you look at the nationalities, for instance, when you check off the box Asian, they ask what country you're from, and you can write in anything, but the ones that they've got checkboxes for are Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese, Filipino, Chinese, Hawaiian, Guamian, Samoan, basically places that we've either invaded or colonized. And the journalist Juan Gonzalez calls this the harvest of empire. You know, you go somewhere and somewhere comes back to you. And so our racial categories are this funny sort of history. As you read down that form, every group that gets its own category is a group that's been important in American history, either as a group that's been colonized or a group that's been invaded or a group that's been enslaved. It's not a pretty history. In some ways, those questions are there, you know, because if you've done the crime, you've got to do the time, which is to say, if we set up an aspect of American society that's based on race, we kind of have an obligation to continue looking at that situation until we can rectify it, to understand how those behaviors that have been going on for 100 years or more in various cases shape the America we live in today.
That is interesting. The history of America is embedded in your census form, coming to your door near you soon. We've been speaking with Gregory Smith-Simon, who is a professor of sociology and pays attention to all this stuff. Gregory, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And coming up next here on the Mike McEntee Show, breaking news. Did Donald Trump know about the $130,000 paid on his behalf to a porn actress? Trump has asked, and for the first time, answers the question to the press. That story next.
The Electric Fetus wants your used music. The used music buying bonanza is going on now at the Electric Fetus. Sell them your vinyl, CDs, and DVDs from now through April 17th and receive an extra 50% based on the quote if you choose store credit. That's 50% more to use on more music or even in the gift department. There's no better time to bring the Electric Fetus your used LPs, CDs, and DVDs. Find the Electric Fetus just south of downtown Minneapolis at 2000 4th Avenue South. Open 9 to 9 on weekdays, 9 to 8 on Saturdays, and 11 to 6 on Sundays.
As Trump assembles a war cabinet, including John Bolton as National Security Advisor and Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State, as the U.S. continues to wage war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, and as Trump threatens war with North Korea, it is time to act. Stop the endless U.S. wars. Say no to new wars with Iran or North Korea. Join an anti-war protest on Sunday, April 15th, that is part of National Spring Actions Against Endless War. Gather at Hennepin and Lagoon at 1:30. March at 2 p.m. with a return to the starting location. As the doomsday clock is set for 2 minutes to midnight and the military budget grows, demand money for housing, education, and the environment. Join the anti-war protest on April 15th at Hennepin and Lagoon in Minneapolis. Gather at 1:30, march at 2. Initiated by Minnesota Peace Action Coalition. For more information, call 612-827-5364. That's 612-827-5364.
Saturdays at 1 p.m., you have a chance at a fresh start, a new beginning. Hi, everybody. This is Freddie Bell, host of New Beginnings. Our show features the concerns of America's 78 million baby boomers in employment, finance, health and nutrition, spirituality, and even entertainment. Every day is a chance for a fresh start. Join us Saturdays at 1 p.m. for New Beginnings with Freddie Bell on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. A couple breaking news stories here coming out of Washington, D.C. Obviously, we'll hear more about this probably at the top of the hour, but I want to pass them along to you. You've heard before about Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt and the concerns about his spending on office furniture, first-class travel, and security coverage, as well as requests for bulletproof vehicle, an expanded 20-person protective detail. Well, maybe you haven't heard about all that, but some of it has been out there, and at least five officials of the EPA, four of them high-ranking, were reassigned or demoted or requested new jobs in the past year after they raised concerns about the spending and management of the agency's administrator, Scott Pruitt. This is according now to the New York Times, which has been covering this. Mr. Pruitt bristled when officials, four career EPA employees and one Trump administrator political appointee, confronted him. This is according to sources. The White House has declined to comment on this, referring questions to the EPA, though Mr. Trump, as he boarded Air Force One today, he said he had confidence in Mr. Pruitt. And speaking to reporters on the plane, he described Mr. Pruitt as very courageous, while suggesting he was reviewing the complaints about him. I'll make that determination, he said, but he's a good man. He's done a terrific job, but I'll take a look at it. Now, also on that same plane, President Trump denied knowing of a $130,000 payment his lawyer made to a pornographic film actress who claims to have had a sexual encounter with him. He's referred the questions to the transaction to his personal lawyer, but this is his first public remarks about the matter. Asked by a reporter whether he knew about the payment to the actress, Stephanie Clifford, known in her films as Stormy Daniels, he said no. Asked why his personal lawyer, Michael D. Cohen, had made the payment, Trump said, "You'll have to ask Michael." The president said he did not know where the money came from. Now, Stormy Daniels' lawyer is on Twitter and immediately shot back once this broke, saying, We very much look forward to testing the truthfulness of Mr. Trump's feigned lack of knowledge concerning the $130,000 payment as stated on Air Force One. As history teaches us, it is one thing to deceive the press and quite another to do so under oath. Now, Trump was in West Virginia, and I know you'll be shocked that he made an allegation that has no supporting evidence. He's alleging without evidence that voter fraud is a huge problem in California. Trump said that, quote, in many places like California, the same person votes many times. He said, quote, they always like to say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Not a conspiracy theory, folks. Millions and millions of people. He provided no evidence of this, of course, but after the 2016 election, Trump alleged repeatedly, without evidence, that voting fraud cost him the popular vote. Remember, Trump lost the popular vote. That's something that we sometimes forget. And he lost it by millions and millions of votes. Earlier this year, he disbanded a voter fraud commission amid infighting and lawsuits as state officials refused to cooperate. While there have been isolated cases of voter fraud in the U.S., past studies have found it to be very rare. Now, yesterday, we played you a part of a viral video showing how Sinclair, one of the largest owners of local TV stations, was having its anchors all read the same right-wing talking points about media bias. Well, now the consumer watchdog organization Allied Progress is trying to prevent Sinclair from acquiring even more stations in a proposed merger with Tribune Media. Allied has made a six-figure one-week ad buy, and get this, this is in your face, to run on, this is an anti-Sinclair announced advertisement. It is going to run on four Sinclair-owned stations in Washington, D.C., Des Moines, Seattle, and their flagship station in Baltimore, starting this Friday. A very in-your-face message that sounds like this.
Sinclair owns this station and nearly 200 others. It forced dozens of anchors to recite the same political message, word for word. Now Sinclair is trying to control local news stations in 72% of American homes. Tell the FCC to stop the Sinclair merger.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Now, Allied is calling for the FCC to put a stop to the merger, which will result in the largest local TV news monopoly in American history, with Sinclair stations reaching 72% of households in the United States. You can find more by just doing hashtag Stop Sinclair on Twitter. That's it for today's show. A reminder that we have the CD8 form that happened last night. This is a congressional form in Cloquet. Mining was the big divisive issue for the DFL party up there. We have pulled that segment over on the Uptake. It's about 11 minutes. You can easily watch it. And remember, support the Uptake for covering these kinds of things at theuptake.org. See you back here tomorrow.